You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Okay, so if you were with us last week, you would have met Mark Fitchett again. And he is the pelagic fishery ecosystem scientist for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. I know, long title. But we also, since we had him in, thought, wait a minute, let's put the hook into him for something international. Last time we talked about the recovery program that's ongoing for the white-tipped shark. And it just dawned on me that he has a lot of expertise. And as everybody at the council wears several hats, you have to. We can actually discuss some of the other issues that affect us from an international standpoint. We know that here in Hawaii, Mark, that we're kind of far away, and we're pretty lucky. There aren't too many bad guys visiting us inshore. We don't see too many people because of where we are geographically. But then there are, what, like three big parts of the Pacific that we interplay with,
right,
that are the international ends of the issue. What are some of the issues that are ongoing there that you all are working on that have ramifications or affect Hawaii?
Well, you know, we have obviously ahi tuna is the tuna is king here.
Yeah. Tuna is the boss of the Pacific.
Ahi is life. You know, here we have multiple fisheries that fish for tuna, for ahi tuna. You've got, you know, your Palawai, Ikashibi, troll guys, your green stickers. You know, you've got a group of fisheries, inter-island fisheries. And then you have an high seas international domestic fleet of longliners that are here. And so there is a consistent demand for local fresh Hawaii product. There's a mainland demand for Hawaii ahi, fresh ahi. There's you've seen on the mainland this growing demand of poke.
Yeah, they're really getting into that, by the way.
There is, yeah. And they're putting fruit on it. What's up with that? I go there, they got mango and apples on it.
And they say, this isn't raw fish, is it?
Yeah, right. It kind of is. They think it's put core. I saw on Instagram.
It's like a Waldorf salad with ahi in it.
Yeah, it's like a Cobb salad. Yeah, exactly. With ahi on it. It's funny because a lot of, you know, I'm not, you know, locally born and raised here, but you know, living here enough, you develop a little bit of acumen on what is good Hawaiian fresh ahi.
Yeah.
And so there's a demand, and it's a healthy fish. Nutritionally, it's got a great value. And so we're in a weird, I should not say weird. We are in a strategic, advantageous, geographical and geo-ecological position. We are north of the equator, so we have some of the equatorial warm waters. We're in a tropical environment, and we're literally in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
You know what's really interesting? When you take a look at the historic occurrence of weather concerns, whether they be tsunami or hurricane, the Hawaiian Islands are uniquely positioned that most of it bypasses us. You know, when you take a look at it, yeah, we get our storms and we have had them, but there are other areas in the Pacific that they have to rebuild their houses every couple of years. We get lucky here.
Oh, yeah. We were just in Saipan. I had a council meeting in Saipan in October.
Wait a minute. You guys were there.
Yeah, we were right in the middle of it.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Hurricane U2. And we're not talking about the band U2. We're talking about the typhoon that was a mega typhoon or super typhoon. Yeah. And it was catastrophic, but
spooky.
It was creepy. And just an aside, I was a little bit disappointed that this news did not make the mainland. I mean, this is a U.S. territory, Pacific Island. It should have gotten more attention, I think, by the national and by folks in D.C. Yeah. But that's a different story. But it was interesting, you know, because those folks are so resilient and they're so used to these and they're prepared. And it was impressive just to talk to our friends and colleagues there, how fast that they've been resilient. And here in Hawaii is the same thing. We're in we do get our fair share of storms, but we are also, at least on Oahu, we are protected by Maui Nui, you know, and then we're also protected by the fact that we have the northern equatorial current. You have these trade winds that persist. And so a lot of the storm activity is sort of pushed north of us and northwest of us and because of the way that the oceans, the ocean circulation and trade winds. But, you know, with climate change, that could change. So let's just keep that in mind. You know, we're seeing more and more anomalous oceanographic features.
But it does make us rather unique because there are certain other places in the Pacific where it's opposite. Every storm hits them, you know?
Every storm hits them. And so the frequency of storms can be, you know, depressed or elevated. Mm-hmm. But here, you know, but these same things, these same functional ecosystem drivers or physical drivers that are driving, you know, these the climatic and oceanographic events are also driving the distribution of our fisheries. You know, we've had issues with range contraction of aku, of skipjack.
Sure,
You know, we don't have a fishery for them anymore, much of a fishery for them anymore, particularly due to the closure at Pearl Harbor. But, you know, the species themselves have contracted due to climate change and also due to fishing. Albacore is another one. They've been pushed further out. But here we're at the epicenter of ahi. We have a Western Central Pacific stock that has many different substocks or subgroups. And then we have the Eastern Pacific. And so the fish here, the ahi, and when I mean ahi, I'm speaking broadly of yellowfin and big eye tuna. There has been a lot of emerging scientific information that would essentially say, and in prior shows we discussed this, that maybe we have a resident stock, but we also have fish that come from the east and from the west, and we have these management entities.
These are the three areas that we're talking about
today. The three areas we're talking about
that deal with us. Yeah.
And from a scientific standpoint, and I'm going to go talk less from a management, but more from a scientific standpoint. We have the IATTC, which is what's called an RFMO. An RFMO is a regional fishery management organization. So the
RFMO.
Our IATTC, so I'm going to give you an acronym soup here, is their purview is the Eastern Pacific.
All right.
So that is at about 140, 145 west. So that's far from here, but not technically, relatively not too far from here. We do have some boats that fish.
That interact,
And fish in the east. Also, those fish from the east come here. Mm-hmm. So there is some management issues, but also scientifically as well. So you have the Western Central Pacific. And the Western Central Pacific fisheries are divided into two science providers. They're different than the IATTC, which is, by the way, that stands for the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission.
Glad you're not me doing that.
That is the Eastern Pacific.
Right.
So moving on to the Western and Central, right? So that is Hawaii and the waters to the north and south is another large area that the science providers, we have two science providers. We have what's called the ISC, which is the International Standing Committee for Tuna and Tuna-Like Species. International Science Committee for Tuna and Tuna-Like Species. That's a mouthful as well. Yeah. So we have the ISC, and their purview is mostly 20 degrees north. So that's the north. And then you have the Secretary of the Pacific Community, or now called the Pacific Community, and we refer to them as the SPC. So you have these three science providers that do stock assessments. And so coming up this summer, or the next few weeks, we're going to have a series of meetings, first starting in the east. That will be in May. And then in July, we'll be at the ISC meeting, which is going to be held in Taipei, Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And then the science provider to the south, or to the broader science provider, the SPC, will be presenting their scientific research at Pohnpei in August. So some of the issues that are emerging are in the Eastern Pacific is big eye tuna and yellowfin tuna.
Okay.
And it is assumed that that stock in the last stock assessment, both yellowfin and big eye, are not doing as well. They've been categorized as overfished. Big eye, yellowfin tuna is just barely overfishing. And so that has some implications here in Hawaii, and also may raise some scientific concerns over stock structure.
Okay.
So
now,
that's emerging.
I can tell you, what you said earlier, folks, you got to understand this. What Mark was talking about is that almost all of us growing up thought that all of the tuna that we had was migratory. We were waiting for the Japan current. We're waiting for this. We're waiting for that. Then it became more and more obvious, scientifically speaking, over the years, that, wait a minute, there seems to be at least some indigenous yellowfin in the Hawaiian Islands, and maybe even some big eye. Now it turns out to be that it's almost certainly that there is a yellowfin standalone bunch of fish in the main Hawaiian Islands.
Right.
You know, and it's pretty hard to deny that because it's like they're there.
Yeah. And so we need to differentiate. We have fish here. So Kurt Schaefer, who is a world-renowned tuna biologist, he is a character and a great person to get to know. He categorized essentially the big eye tuna, and I can imagine yellowfin tuna are the same as you have resident fish, and mm-hmm. then you have the occasional fish that may migrate.
The visitor,
yeah, right. or one yeah, that may yeah, come yeah. and chase food and then come back, yeah. or mm-hmm. chase a ocean current into another area, and then return back. So those, they still have what we call a degree of natal homing, meaning they come back mm-hmm. to an area either to spawn or just they're just genetically entrenched into coming to an area.
Let me tell you what I found interesting many years ago when the theory first came up. Every now and again, there was a run of big fish, you know, big ahi, big yellowfin. And it was said to be, these are this is a traveling school of major, big, large fish that are going who knows where to do what. Then a couple of years later, the biggest fish would be 100 pounds instead of 200 or 250 pounds. So that sort of set up the yin and yang. Well, maybe we have a local fishery and they can't get bigger because we catch them, mm-hmm. you know. And these other ones, they come from who knows where maybe they have several years to become bigger because nobody's catching them.
Or maybe those big ones were here and yeah. the small ones are ones
exactly.
you're passing through.
So the jury's still out.
Yeah. yeah. And so tagging work, you know, so there's two things. And there's two things that are drawing this. And I love talking to fishermen because, you know, when you speak to these folks, they come up with they give you a starting point of where you come up with hypotheses
yeah,
that's
yeah.
going on.
I love that.
And especially here in Hawaii, the folks here are phenomenal. And so when you start looking at these pulses of fish that come through, there's two things at play. You have a resident stock that maybe, plus you have some transients, you have your visitors, and you also have your perpetual nomad fish.
Yeah.
And big eye tuna are like that as well. You have fish that just move, they just continuously move. They don't really, they're like a cowboy with no home, right? They go around and they're a perpetual nomad. But you have a lot of fish that, you know, have a home, mm-hmm. a home range. And at the same time, so you get a mixture of these visitors passing through, but also yellowfin tuna are so prolific in the recruitment, meaning when I say recruitment, that is individuals that enter a fishery or that that go with a cohort. And they're very sensitive to the environment. So you could have an environmental event like an El Nino or a La Nina, which brings about a propensity of recruitment and recruitment success. So you start to see these cohorts passing through, and they can either remain or be transient fish. Mm-hmm. So that's something to take into consideration. There's lots of processes that come into play, but studies looking at genetics and microchemistry of yellowfin tuna have shown that largely, we have a Hawaii stock mm-hmm. or a Hawaii subpopulation. And then with big eye tuna, the same study showed that there is between the Line Islands, which is south of here, in Hawaii, we actually have a group, a subgroup too, based on a microchemistry. What they're doing is they're looking at chemical markers in the ear bones of fish.
Which, by the way, is highly being utilized now. I mean, it's a great development because it sort of lends credence to this theory when you can say, all right, look, you know, here it is. It proves it.
But then you have age. Exactly.
Yeah.
They use the otoliths for age too.
Yeah.
But also, you also have tagging. And it's interesting because my good friend and colleague, Molly Luckavage, has been tagging ahi here.
She's fascinating.
She's awesome. Yeah. Her and Tim and Clay Tam with Pacific Fisheries Group are great people. But they put out tags and they found that, wow, these fish are moving east. So that,
but wait a minute,
and that could have been we got on a group of transient fish to the east, and you don't want to draw broad sweeping conclusions based on a small sample size. So that's why you need to do a mixture of these continuous monitoring studies to show that how much of the our fish are going to the east and to the west, and how much are necessarily are remaining. And it's a fascinating issue. But largely, we do more than likely have our own resident population of ahi, big eye, and yellowfin. But then how much of the fish that are available are transients? So that's what what boils down to. So you use tagging to look at fish flow or the movement of fish in the region, but then you look at genetics of looking at gene flow. How much genetically, how much of do we have a distinct population? And these same studies are needed also, as we discussed last week, on oceanic white tip. So there's lots of issues in the management and coming up with decisions. So that is an issue that is ongoing. Yeah. But as we mentioned, internationally, you have this, you have the Eastern Pacific stock, which isn't doing too well. And there's different.
It isn't doing too well specifically because of overfishing?
Because of overfishing. Yeah. There's also been an issue, and this is a ubiquitous issue in both the Atlantic, the Western Pacific, and the Eastern Pacific, is you're getting the growing purseine fleet. Mm-hmm. Which has been targeting, you know, skipjack and yellowfin. They have been also incidentally been taking a disproportionate number of small big eye tuna.
Yeah.
And
which is a huge threat.
Which is an issue. Yeah. And that opens up some conflicts between other fisheries. You have the longline fishery and troll fisheries here in Hawaii, which take larger individuals, but those spawning young of year big eye tuna are subjected to disproportionate levels of fishing mortality due to the purseine fishery.
Okay.
So that's a conflict there. And then in the Eastern Pacific, that is what's likely going on. In the Atlantic, that is what's been going on as well.
The only problem there is, and people have a hard time getting it, is that we know how specifically expensive it is to have good yellowfin, good big eye, good ahi. And a lot of these purseiners, they're not worried about the sashimi market.
Yeah.
They're worried about tonnage. They're worried about cat food. They're worried about canning. You know, they're not worried about the same thing that we are.
There is good quality products that do come from the purseine industry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But let's make sure that people know that too.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at a price per pound, so there's two things going on with big eye tuna and yellowfin. Is you have a biological trade-off cost benefit from these fisheries between the longline troll and then with the purseine fishery. Mm-hmm. So economically, the price per pound. So the price per pound of a small big eye tuna is pennies on the dollar compared to a nice, fat, beautiful, you know, sashimi grade big eye yellowfin caught here or caught in the longline fishery. So you have an economic disproportion, a price per pound issue. But then even striking is you have a disproportionate yield per recruit issue, meaning that the longline fishery is taking larger individuals that per individual yield more biomass.
Mm-hmm.
And also those individuals have also already spawned. So you have it's a double whammy.
Gotcha.
Right? So your price per pound, or I would say it's a triple whammy. Your price per pound is higher on the larger individuals. The reproductive output is larger on the larger individuals that are taken. And then on top of that, the individual, so you take an individual fish, there's more yield to that individual.
Sure.
So there's there's major trade-offs.
So it's a triple whammy taking one of those fish out of the water.
Yeah, taking right? it, yeah, well, yeah. And then, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and yeah. and the so the SPC in the Western Central Pacific puts out reports on estimating numbers and weights of big eye tuna by size class.
Okay.
And when you look at the Indonesian ringnet fisheries and the purseine fisheries, they're taking smaller individuals. They're taking biomass levels oftentimes that exceed, you know, in some cases exceed the adults. But then when you start looking at the numbers, when those translate to numbers of fish, it's orders of magnitude higher.
Amazing.
So there's issues there that need to be reconciled. And so there's some conflicts there that go on in both and all the oceans. So those are some merging issues that go on. The big eye tuna stock in the east has been, you know, a little bit below, and with the degree of uncertainty, maximum sustainable yield. But we're expecting a new stock assessment coming up in May, and I've not seen the results of that. In the Western Central Pacific, we have another one coming next year.
Yeah, but by the way, some of these stock assessments are getting more valuable because they're closer together. I do know that a lot of these statistics that we've been drawing on are sometimes, you know, 10 years old. I mean, you know, having somebody something that old, better than having nothing. But the more, what have you done for me lately is more important.
Yeah, yeah. And Big Eye Tuna, it has been in the east, in the Eastern Pacific, the IATTC meeting, which I'll be going to in May. They have been pushing for an increased frequency of stock assessments because there is there's a lot of money involved, and there's management decisions that need to be made with higher degree of precision and frequency. So the IATTC has been working phenomenal. They have some of the best scientists in the world who are doing the assessment on Big Eye Tuna this year and Yellowfin Tuna. So we're getting some emerging information there. There's also emerging scientific information coming from the east. In the Western Central Pacific, same story. They're going to be doing an update next year. We're expecting, I think, skipjack tuna this year is going to be assessed.
Yeah, that, you know, something, this came up a couple of weeks ago. It comes up from time to time. When I was a kid, and whenever you begin a sentence saying "when I was a kid," you're looking back in the time. I can remember when the skipjack fishery here was absolutely huge. I mean, we had aku boats all over the place in the harbor. We had this huge supply of skipjack. They'd go out there, they'd come back in a loaded boat, sometimes little rascals, sometimes 20 pounders, and first of all, the number of boats catching those has dwindled down. And number two, I think they kind of got fished out.
They got fished out relatively locally, maybe not a whole as a population. Because so what happens is with fish like aku, and there's also climate change issues, which there's been.
Would have been denied up until recently.
There's been some environmental, and there's been studies. And that's interesting. I'm fascinated by aku. John Hampton, who's a biologist, SPC, is the same way. Skipjack tuna are, you know, very prolific spawners. Their environmental, their reaction to the environment around them is so fascinating. So for starters, the aku fishery dwindled and was talking to some folks here. The nail in the coffin was after 9/11. The boats couldn't get the Nehu out of Pearl Harbor,
and that was a big killer. And the other thing is, of course, that you know everybody knows that aku doesn't travel at all. Doesn't travel well.
Doesn't keep?
Keep. However,
it's delicious though.
It is, and there are certain parts of the world where they could care less about that because the minute it's caught, it's frozen. I mean, the minute it gets into a boat, it's going to be, in some cases, filleted at sea and frozen and used for who knows what. But the actual local population prefers sashimi or a poke made from aku because of its blood.
It's very
oil.
Dark red. Yeah. And it's healthy. It's lean.
Yeah.
So going back to your question about aku, and this is something that fascinates me, is that aku, tagging studies have shown that they're mean displacement, meaning an individual travels more than in any other.
It's surprising.
Tuna.
Most people think they live on that reef. That's where they live.
So they move a lot. And they, you know, and they're always moving from one out, and they're very skittish. We know by boat, but people who fish for them here, they're very skittish. They move very quickly in big groups, but also they've been subjected to what's called range contraction, which is due to fishing and also due to the environment. Range contraction is essentially when you have a large population of individuals, they are not as dense, they're more widespread. Mm-hmm. But what happens is when a population is fished more and more, they actually condense. They actually become a more dense a group of fish, and so their range will contract, but the catchability or the density of individuals will actually increase. And that can be due to fishing, but also due to the environment. And there was a study that was put out by Sanina and Lahoti last year that was brought to the Science Committee meeting of the WCPFC, which is the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission. It's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a mouthful, I should say.
So those two scientists last year, and they're going to update it this year in Pohnpei and Micronesia in August, these two scientists put a study that showed that due to climate change and the environmental phenomena that we are experiencing with rising ocean temperatures, is that actually we're starting to see a range shift to the east of Aku and albacore. So we're actually expecting later down the line that the eastern Pacific will end up getting more and more of these Aku resources because of the shift of the environment.
Yeah, that's really interesting. By the way, what Mark is talking about, some of you that may not be as familiar with albacore as Tombo, Tombo never has been the Aku or the tuna of choice in the Hawaiian Islands for raw, because it's not oily, nor is it as bloody. But it is the more sought-after meat of the albacore in back east. And whether it's because of the cookability of it or how it takes sauces, who knows? But that's why, you know, it's so interesting when people say, oh, no, I don't want the albacore. It's not oily enough.
Yeah, and I'm not. I really haven't. Yeah, I'm not a connoisseur for albacore.
I love it. I'll
eat it. Well, I look at you can just tell by looking at me that I'll eat virtually anything. But anyway, but albacore and skipjack tuna, which are very prolific spawning, they're very productive. But what's happening is there's concern with both those species because a lot of these island nations, whether it's the Micronesian islands and in Samoa, you know, catch rates of albacore have gone down. But yet the stock seems to be healthy. So the stock is still at a healthy biomass level. But what's happened with albacore is that in 2017, China took 45,000 metric tons of albacore. And which was about 46% of the total catch.
It's an awful lot of fish.
And that's an awful lot of fish. And so these highly industrialized entities are removing biomass at a rate that may be interfering with some of these island small fleets, but also due to climate issues.
Well, it's also another thing, and this has not been spoken about too many times on my show, but it comes up on others, and that is, there are huge segments of the population in that part of the world that were not fish eaters, you know, from the interior of the country and from other places that were meat eaters. And now that they have the ability to catch fish, they're actually creating more fish eaters.
Yeah.
And that gets kind of scary because we're talking millions and millions of people.
Billions.
And once they start developing a taste for something, they demand it.
And there's a big concern in the Indian Ocean because you have a growing human population. I think it was read somewhere that I'm trying to think, Dar es Salaam and East Africa is supposed to, their population of Dar es Salaam, the city, is supposed to go like increase fivefold in 25 years. You have India, the population in India and in Southeast Asia that is relying on Indian Ocean resources, and then China, which is, you know, which is sort of competing for fishery resources not only with Japan, when Japan's becoming more and more engaging with some conservation measures, because, you know, you got a growing human population in China that is relying more and more on fishery resources, to call it in the equatorial Pacific.
Well, let's come home for a minute and ask this theoretical question. We know that right now in the main Hawaiian Islands, census has been pretty steady. however, up until recently, we were having phenomenal growth in the population. That means, you know, everything around it, the food sources get impacted. You got to have more and more. And there's nothing to suggest that our fish in the ocean around Hawaii is increasing. I mean, you know, there's a balance of fish, right? And so it's not good sense to assume that the more people you have and the more people that go fishing, catching fish to eat, that the fish are going to keep up with the demand.
That's true. We do also have, and it goes to the, we do also have populations of fish that are very prolific in mm-hmm. their production.
Yeah.
But also, when you a population that is larger, for example, doesn't always necessarily on a per capita basis isn't necessarily more productive.
Gotcha.
So yeah, that's why why you look at maximum being biomass at maximum sustainable yield, so that per that individual or that population size can maximize its replenishment. So that's one thing to take into consideration. The other thing is, due to climate variability, we've had winners and losers mm-hmm. In ocean productivity. And by the way, I'm speaking specifically of pelagic fisheries. Reef and bottom fish fishery.
Different.
It's a different story. Okay, I want to make that very clear to the listener. But also, relatively speaking, the population growth of Hawaii, even though we look around and we see that the urbanization of Oahu is a great example, that population growth relative to the ocean resource is still extremely insignificant compared to other parts of the world.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so we need to take that in consideration, and we need to make sure that here in Hawaii and the Pacific Islands, we're ensuring the access, equitable and fair access to fisheries resources.
Yeah, and you know, that's happening throughout right now the main Hawaiian Islands. Those of you that are listening that are parts of clubs or groups, it is your right to eat. It is your right to fish. And nobody's going to impact that. There's some people that are fighting tooth and nail about having licensing and all of that stuff. And they just don't understand that maybe licensing is good because the money you collected gets put back into the fishery. Look at how many of these studies that are done that are dependent on grants and money. If they dry up, all of a sudden these scientists that have all of this energy to go and do this project have no incentive because they're going to eat. You know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, so I think there's a fine line in there. That's right. What you said is we shouldn't be scared or worried that we're eating all our fish. You know, I mean, we should be concerned that can happen.
We need to be more concerned about bigger picture issues.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
we should be concerned about climate change. We should be concerned about international cooperation, at least in my opinion. And the council is here. I mean, one thing that the council, we're unique. Mm-hmm. We have six fishery management councils here, and we're the ones, because we're out in the middle of the ocean, and we actually have a much larger international footprint than any other region in the United States. We have a large international presence. Our tuna fishery here is the largest anywhere else.
Within
the United States. So we need to be concerned, but be pragmatic.
Yeah.
And you brought up the point about licensing. A lot of other small island nations are they're actually economically dependent on licensing from other foreign fleets.
Absolutely, they are. Yeah.
So there's
a different kind of licensing, but yeah, you bet.
And we need to incentivize other nations to comply and to play ball fairly. But you know, we're in a fascinating and a very exciting time right now, especially with better scientific information. But also, we need to be very careful because there's been some very drastic measures proposed on the international arena, such as one thing we've been discussing at council is this BB&J, which is Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, which is an effort, an UN, United Nations Convention under the Law of the Sea, that is sort of may have some undertones from a lot of environmental NGOs that are pushing for high seas closures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that can be a little bit dangerous, especially with respect to food security for the U.S., when we already have a disproportionate, I would say a woefully disproportionate level of closures to pelagic fisheries relative to other areas.
Yeah, and that's a great place to finish this conversation. Going to count on getting you back in with these more meetings that are coming up during the summer and all of that stuff. Mark, thanks very much.
Look forward to catching up.
Yep. Okay, when we come back. We won't come back. I'm done for the day. I forgot about that. But thank you very much for being a part of the program. And if you'd like to contribute, themikebuckshow@gmail.com will work. In the meantime, go catch lots of fish. Save some for us. And never don't go fish for the sake of fishing. Go fishing for the sake of eating. And if you are going to go fishing for the sake of fishing, make sure you can release that fish. Hey, thanks for listening. See you next time. Aloha.